Hey, hey, welcome to another edition of Animal Trust, streaming live on internet radio, where our allegiance is to the animals and not to the institutions which raise money and claim to do so on their behalf. I am your host, Nathan Winograd, and you are listening to the voice of a no-kill nation.
Animal Trust Radio is brought to you by the National No-Kill Advocacy Center. The No-Kill Advocacy Center is working with progressive shelters nationwide to end the systematic killing of animals in shelters and working just as hard with animal lovers to force change in those shelters which refuse to do so. Visit us on the web at www.nokilladvocacycenter.org. A no-kill nation is within our reach. Sponsorship also provided by Almaden Books, publishers of quality nonfiction books. Almaden Books is proud to bring you Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution in America, the book that has been called powerful, inspirational, a must-read for anyone who cares about animals, and the Bible of the no-kill movement. Available wherever books are sold. Almaden Books. Behind every progressive movement is an intellectual tradition.
Today on Animal Trust Radio, the Humane Society of the United States says that millions of people are bitten by dogs every year in the U.S. They say that millions seek medical attention after being attacked by dogs, that insurance companies spend billions of dollars on the victims of these bites, and that people who don't want dogs killed must share the blame for this. But are these claims true? And are we left with only two choices, as HSUS suggests, having to choose between children or dogs? We challenge this fear-mongering by HSUS, look for an epidemic of dog bites that turns out not to exist, put blame where it firmly belongs, and finally ask and answer the question about whether it is ethical to kill dogs. Fear-mongering. I chose a child's face over my dog, says author John Katz, in an HSUS interview that demonizes the opposition. That's coming up on Animal Trust Radio. Over 150 years ago, Henry Berg started North America's first humane society, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. While early humane efforts primarily focused on protecting animals who had been forced into labor, it did not take long for Berg and his SPCA to set their sights on the abuses of local dog catchers. The other SPCAs, humane societies, and animal welfare groups that began to dot the American landscape, though distinct and independent, nevertheless modeled themselves after Berg's ASPCA. While local pounds were busy killing animals, treating them poorly in the process, humane groups were fighting to lower death rates and better their plight. In many ways, the battle rages to this very day. While animal control is claiming to protect people from the often incorrectly perceived threats caused by animals, animal welfare groups are trying to protect animals from people. These have always been two very distinct movements, opposing each other on fundamental issues of life and death. While we can try to bring these opposing principles closer together, the tension can never be eliminated. In the no-kill philosophy, we try to reconcile them as much as possible, forcing accountability onto animal control so that the only animals killed are those who are irremediably suffering, hopelessly ill or injured with a poor or grave prognosis, or in the case of dogs, truly vicious. But for 93% or so of the animals who do not fit these definitions, the no-kill philosophy not only demands that shelters save them, but through the no-kill equation, comprehensively and rigorously implemented so that they replace killing entirely, provides the key to do so. It is only through the no-kill philosophy that we begin to truly reduce the disparity between animal control and animal welfare in a way that is fair to the animals and, for example, protects the public from the truly vicious dog. That doesn't mean that there aren't some irreconcilable tensions. But it does mean we have put our cards on the table so that we can make decisions and distinctions in a fair and open manner. When we simply ignore the distinctions, pretending to ourselves and to the American public that no such disparity exists, or when we call ourselves one thing but profess the opposite, we come dangerously close to the dictionary definition of lying. At the very least, we are misrepresenting ourselves, hiding behind the veneer of animal welfare or animal protection when we really promote a philosophy that puts animals last, or worse, even allows them to be executed based on unfair, misleading, impermissible, and thoughtless claims. Among other things, this is the very heart of what is wrong with the Companion Animal Division at the Humane Society of the United States, and it is why I have long argued that it should be disbanded. Better to disband a dysfunctional department which promotes a vision at odds with its public animal welfare claims than to allow it to undermine the work of no-kill proponents across the country. The Humane Society of the United States claims to be about saving animals, about promoting the bonds between people and animals, and about leading the cause of animal welfare. But how can this be reconciled with their support for the mass killing of healthy dogs and cats in shelters to this very day? Or with their historical claim that mass killing of feral cats is the only practical and humane solution? It simply cannot. As to the question of why they insist on taking positions that are, at their core, inherently antithetical to animal welfare, we must look to the actors who make up the leadership of the organization, particularly the HSUS Companion Animal Division. Here, the term actor is deliberate, because while they play the public persona of animal lovers, who would leave no stone unturned if it held out the promise of saving lives, the reality is that historically and presently, the leadership comes primarily from the ranks of animal control, from a mindset that animals can and should be killed, that people must be protected from them without regard for true risk analysis, and even that killing them is an act of kindness. HSUS functionaries often come from animal control organizations that kill animals, and they carry that mindset with them to a new organization that is supposed to have a different mission. And so they denigrate the animals they are supposed to protect, and use HSUS as a mouthpiece to veil their reactionary animal control agendas under the cloak of animal welfare. And the public has, until recently, accepted it, because this view has dominated the national discussion of companion animals for so long, and has essentially been the only voice, until the no-kill movement called it into question. In fact, the lack of challenge to this position has convinced many animal activists to accept extreme Orwellian notions that killing is kindness, that cats are better off dead than outdoors, that dogs and cats should be killed, because it comes cloaked in the mantle of large national animal welfare groups. As a result, they have essentially been brainwashed to think that animal control based on killing poses no contradiction with an animal welfare mission, even though the latter has an altogether different philosophical underpinning. And as long as groups like HSUS simply ignore the distinction and bring animal control mindsets to animal welfare without a bridging philosophy that is ethical and rigorous, animal control based on killing will continue to ride roughshod over animal welfare, and compassion will fall victim to control. For anyone who loves cats, HSUS's history of villainizing, vilifying, and calling for their mass killing has been a sad and tragic reality. It was HSUS which called the mass slaughter of feral cats in shelters the only practical and humane solution. It was HSUS which asked a criminal prosecutor to find that TNR programs are a violation of state anti-cruelty laws and can subject caretakers to jail and prosecution. It was HSUS that spread fear-based hysteria about cats and bird flu, even as the World Health Organization found no risk. It is HSUS which falsely accuses cats of being a public rabies threat, of decimating wildlife, of being invasive non-native intruders, and of causing neighborhood strife. It is HSUS which instructed shelters to denigrate cats by having them document public health problems that relate to cats, include diseases that are spread from cat to cat, as well as those spread between cats and other animals, without regard for real risk analysis. And it is HSUS which continues to legitimize shelter killing of healthy and treatable cats by promoting their killing in shelters as a necessity. As cat lovers, we have long rejected the fear-based, mistruth-based, and outright inflammatory anti-cat statements coming out of HSUS. Nor were we surprised when they left the Katrina-ravaged Gulf State area with millions of dollars in donations left in the bank unspent, which were supposed to be for animals impacted by the hurricane, even while cats continued to suffer in the area. Nor has HSUS been a true model of ethical advocacy on behalf of dogs either. Like it does for cats, HSUS continues to view the killing of dogs in shelters as both necessary and proper, even if the animals are healthy or treatable. Like cats, the millions raised in the Katrina aftermath, which were not spent, would have helped more dogs too. And unfortunately, when HSUS functionaries attack no-kill and defend shelter killing, as they have in Seattle, Eugene, and Philadelphia, the dogs come away the losers also. But fear-mongering at HSUS has taken a new turn, with the publication of an interview with best-selling author John Katz, author of A Good Dog, in the current issue of Animal Sheltering, entitled, I Chose a Child's Face Over My Dog. The question-and-answer format with Katz does nothing to illuminate the truth about aggression or dangerous dogs, and in fact only serves to heighten stereotypes and perpetuate myths. That Katz killed his dog because of what he considered severe aggression is not what one takes from the article. That would have been a very different piece, a tragedy for all involved, for John Katz, his dog, and the people his dog hurt. And maybe, just maybe, our hearts would have hurt for all of them. Instead, HSUS asks a series of very deliberate questions, which not only globalize the tragedy that occurred in the Katz family, but appear to assume the worst in dogs and the worst in people who want to see less of them killed. Opposition is dismissed as irresponsible. Dog lovers are pitted against children. It's the type of either-or, you are with us or against us, your dog or your child hysteria most of us, especially those of us who love both our dogs and our kids, dismissed long ago. In fact, the parallel to attacks the nascent animal welfare movement was subjected to from industries which hurt animals is stark. Our movement's history is littered with these sorts of unfair accusations by those who profit from animal exploitation. And the tenor of the article, which is merely restated as Katz's viewpoint, giving HSUS plausible deniability about the viewpoint's advance, results in the following conclusions. Killing dogs becomes unacceptable only when people inappropriately humanize dogs. Millions of people are bitten by dogs every year, many tens of thousands of children. If you do not believe in killing dogs, you have made them quasi-religious objects of veneration. Millions of Americans seek medical attention every year for animal bites or attacks. For every troubled or aggressive animal kept alive for months or years, healthy and adoptable animals go wanting for homes and often lose their lives. Insurance companies are paying out billions of dollars to people bitten by dogs. As a result of dog bites, lawyers are injected into the human-animal relationship, and this is the fault of people who want to see dog killing end. Adopting a pit bull appears to be more trouble than it is worth. Every one of these conclusions is deeply flawed and deeply offensive, and unfortunately, John Katz has allowed himself to become a pawn in HSUS's endgame of total hegemony about our role as stewards of dogs and cats, a vision for the future dog lovers across the nation are rejecting. On its website, HSUS says that every year an estimated 4.7 million people are bitten by dogs. But is this true, and are we reduced to a choice between dogs and children? There is little doubt that some dogs are too dangerous for shelters to safely adopt out. The maiming or death of anyone at the hands of a truly vicious dog is a tragedy. No-kill advocates understand this, but what we have been asking for is rigor in making those determinations, not a system of evaluations based on overkill, which is the norm. A system built on protecting dogs and protecting children need not be mutually exclusive. At the end of the day, shelters can save upwards of 93% of dogs and more without endangering the welfare of children by adopting out aggressive dogs. In fact, the experience of shelters who have embraced the culture of life-saving that no-kill represents prove that the vast majority of dogs who enter shelters are friendly. If we take this as a representative sample of dogs in society, then we do not have either an epidemic or even a significant problem of dangerous dogs in the United States that would justify a further clampdown. If, on the other hand, we take dogs who enter shelters to be at higher risk of aggression, say for the sake of argument, we can show that they have less training, spend more time isolated outdoors, have less care than dogs who do not enter shelters, then the situation is actually of less concern, since we would expect to see more aggression in shelter dogs than dogs who live with their families their whole lives. And given that 93% of shelter dogs are friendly to kids, cats, and dogs, the number is higher if we just isolate aggression to people, about 96-97% of dogs. The fear-based hysteria of dangerous dogs becomes demonstrably false. What is true, however, is that public health authorities, dog bite lawyers, the Centers for Disease Control, legislators, animal control shelters, police departments, humane societies, and even national animal welfare groups argue that millions of people are bitten every year by dogs. Some of these groups call for a ban on certain breeds. Others claim we need to teach or enforce responsible pet ownership. Others seek more and tougher laws. But just because they say it is so doesn't make it so. We have to ask the questions, is any of this justified? Are the claims of a dog bite epidemic true? In fact, they are not. And while our hearts go out to the victims of serious dog bite attacks, there is little in the way of evidence that more regulation, more laws, further crackdowns on dogs is justified as a way to prevent these. At the end of the day, the vast majority of dogs are friendly and will never act aggressively. Dogs are already heavily regulated, and there is little by way of additional public policy initiatives that is needed in trying to prevent a dog bite epidemic that simply does not exist. HSUS should stop focusing on this type of fear-based advocacy, stop perpetuating myths, and start educating the public about the truth regarding the dogs they theoretically exist to protect, who they fundraise off of, and who they claim they are working to save. This type of fear-mongering stands the HSUS mission on its head. It is not the job of an animal protection group to mimic the claims of a dog bite lawyer. Where there is fear and misinformation which would call for a crackdown on dogs and dog lovers with little justification and through methods that provide little in the way of actual protection, it is HSUS's job to quell that, not fan the flames of distortion, as they do in this article. Despite an explosion in the number of dogs in the U.S. and their greater integration in society, the number of fatal dog attacks has remained relatively constant for decades. You are 5 times more likely to be killed by a bolt of lightning and 4 times more likely to be killed by a forklift, even though a very small number of people come into contact with these machines. In other words, comparatively speaking, it is exceedingly rare. Despite this, dogs remain heavily regulated. They must be licensed with local authorities. They cannot go into public places without a leash, if at all. They must be vaccinated against rabies. You can't live with more than a small number of them. Animal control officers can seize and destroy them if they determine that they are a nuisance, and the threshold of making a determination that they are dangerous and subject to extermination puts dogs at a disadvantage, even when the facts show otherwise. Together, license laws, leash laws, vaccination laws, pet limit laws, nuisance laws, health codes, property laws, and dangerous dog laws control dogs, in concert with an animal sheltering system built on overkill, that there is little justification to tighten the noose even further. We will never eliminate risk in society. We can minimize it, but in the case of dogs, there is little more that can and should be done. And in many ways, we need to undo some of the laws and regulations because they allow friendly dogs to be killed without making anyone safer. Banning pit bulls or any breed of dog is geared to overkill by definition because, media hysteria to the contrary, the vast majority of dog bites occur within the home by many breeds, with the dog biting a member of the family after some provocation, a different causal mechanism than the false image presented, an epidemic of free-roaming pit bulls attacking unknown children or the elderly. As a result, a breed ban won't stop the vast majority of dog bites. On top of that, roughly 20% of those bites are a result of the dog defending him or herself from being attacked. And although HSUS through John Katz says that millions of Americans seek medical attention every year for animal bites or attacks, what they don't say is that over 92% of dog bites result in no injuries. Let me repeat, over 9 out of 10 bites that do occur result in no one getting hurt, and of those which do result in injury, 7.5% are minor. In fact, they are less severe than any other class of injury. That leaves less than 1% of all bites ranking at moderate or above. Even if HSUS is correct that 4.7 million people are bitten by dogs each year, only 0.0002% result in death, and over 4.66 million people don't actually have anything to really show for it. On top of that, of the 92% which do not result in any injury, the vast majority of those don't constitute force, in that they do not result in pain or restraint. I am not downplaying even the death or maiming of a single person. It is tragic, and as an animal control director, I had no tolerance for the adoption of aggressive dogs. But creating public policy and shelter standards needs careful and thoughtful deliberation, not incendiary fanaticism that reduces everything to a meaningless debate about the value of dogs versus children. So where did this notion come from that the U.S. has a dog bite epidemic? The numbers are simply flawed extrapolations from two government studies, which took a poorly formulated and overly restrictive sample of the population and then simply multiplied those numbers by how many people live in the U.S. One of those samples reported only 6 dog bites, the other 38. That's correct. It is an extrapolation of 6 dog bites. This is the same unscientific method used by HSUS in the past to demonize feral cats by claiming they are killing hundreds of millions of songbirds when the facts show otherwise. When we argue in extremes, the child or the dog, when we set up the problem as a battle of absolutes, no dogs should be killed versus all dogs can be killed, when we demonize people who think we kill too much, when we pretend to be animal welfare yet profess the beliefs of a system based on killing, we do a disservice to our movement, our kids, and our dogs. And while John Katz wrongly believes that for every troubled or aggressive animal kept alive for months or years, healthy and adoptable animals go wanting for homes and often lose their lives, the truth, once again, is more sobering. Healthy and adoptable animals are being killed in shelters because many shelters continue to cling to regressive, archaic policies that allow them to kill dogs, and because HSUS provides them the political cover which allows them to continue. And as long as we allow that as a society and as a movement, dogs will continue to be unfairly blamed and unnecessarily killed because of it. The fact that shelters cannot and should not adopt out vicious dogs does not mean that their killing isn't ethically problematic. I ordered vicious dogs killed when I ran an animal control shelter. I have never believed that shelters should adopt out vicious dogs, and I don't believe that now. Killing truly vicious dogs, so long as shelters rigorously and fairly make those determinations, is politically defensible. I defend it still. But is it truly ethical? It is not. Right now, our great challenge in sheltering is between no-kill advocates who seek to modernize shelters and make them more progressive, and the voices of archaic tradition which say killing is kindness. After the latter voices are silenced and no-kill's hegemony is established, we will then have to confront other ethical quandaries within our own philosophy. Killing dogs who are aggressive but can lead happy lives in sanctuaries, giving animals hospice care as opposed to what we call mercy killings in shelters, these ethical quandaries will become more paramount, and I, for one, look forward to those debates. Because at the end of the day, we deceive ourselves when we think our ethical cost-benefit analysis will not change as our movement grows and as animals become further integrated into our communities. But instead of leading us to a more ethical future, the nation's largest and wealthiest animal welfare group is the nation's leading voice of archaic tradition when it comes to dogs, cats, animal shelters, and the question of life and death. In the 1990s, HSUS wrote an article in which it asked itself rhetorically if the agency would ever promote TNR as opposed to mass killing in U.S. shelters, and whether it would support and defend the work of feral cat caretakers. The response by their vice president of companion animals was emphatic. The answers to these questions are still, and will always be, the same. No, no, and absolutely not. We best serve the animals when we avoid this type of self-delusion. Without the continued pushing of the envelope, without vigorous debate, without constant questioning and reevaluation in light of more information, more knowledge, greater awareness and compassion, more thorough integration of animals in our lives, we become stagnant as a movement. And stagnation is the basis for continued killing, long past the point when we should have known better. By 2005, HSUS informed the feral cat community that it was updating its feral cat position statements to ensure that their policies reflect emerging consensus within the field of animal care and control. Once again, by this admission, HSUS proved itself an unworthy organization in the effort to increase the status of companion animals in society. The role of a humane organization is not to follow consensus, but to lead. Unfortunately, HSUS informed the nation's cat lovers that the largest and wealthiest animal welfare agency in the world was content to establish a policy based on the consensus of animal control agencies nationwide, the very agencies with a history of mass slaughter of feral cats. This is why the average American is far more progressive about dogs and cats than HSUS and every other animal welfare and animal rights organization in the United States, with rare exception. Collectively, we spend over $40 billion on our animals. Giving to animal-related charities is the fastest-growing segment of American philanthropy, and no-kill is on the agenda of local governments nationwide because people are demanding it, despite the efforts to derail its success by these groups. But at the end of the day, it is not about how much we spend, how many animals share our homes, or even about what we seek. In the battle over the hearts and minds of our citizenry, gaining support for no-kill among the American public is a non sequitur because we already have it. While HSUS defends shelter killing of even healthy and friendly animals, while PETA defends it, while the ASPCA defends it, most dog and cat lovers, armed with the facts, find it abhorrent. You're listening to Animal Trust Radio. We'll be right back. That's it for now. Thank you for joining me. I am Nathan Winograd, reminding you that we are over 100 million Americans strong, fighting an entrenched bureaucracy of a few thousand animal shelter directors mired in killing and protected by their large national allies. Never surrender, never give in, never doubt that we will succeed. A no-kill nation is within our reach.
You have been listening to Animal Trust Radio, the voice of a no-kill nation, all rights reserved.